Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies.
Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at School Sucks Show. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
Good morning. Good day, everybody. Today is March 31st. This is Brett, and this is the first part of a two-part final installment in our March theme, The Creative Pursuit. Back in the middle of the month, Nick Hazelton, the anarcho-yakitalist, asked if he could interview me about what we're exploring on the show this month, and I said, yes, Nick, always a pleasure. So, even though we recorded this a while ago, it is going to function as a kind of review here in the podcast chronology. We're going to go over some of the things that we talked about this month, and then Nick is going to ask me some questions about my process for creating the School Sucks podcast, and I'm going to give him some weird answers. We did cover a lot this month, and we had a variety of different perspectives on the topic of creativity, so I hope this show can tie things together and give you some really valuable takeaways. So there are actually more shows to come on this topic. It was kind of a scheduling nightmare this month. Lots of cancellations, and there were a couple of book reviews that I did not get to, and I was also really, really excited about having a conversation with our friend Gardner Goldsmith, who's had a very interesting career as a writer. But because today is the 31st and we are out of time, those things will have to be bonus shows. So over the course of April, please check the website schoolsucksproject.com to see what gets added to the AV Club, our bonus content section. Now, you've heard me say a couple times recently on the show in the past that we are not going to do a theme month in April. So what are we going to do? Ooh, you know, I don't think that I want to announce that here in this monologue using mere words. I think there's other ways that I want to unveil that. So first of all, you know, you should be following me on Twitter. You're probably listening to this show on a device that can access Twitter. So just pick up that device, go to Twitter, search School Sucks Show, and follow. And while you're doing that, I have an Instagram, School Sucks Podcast. So follow me on Instagram. And here's the big one. Most of you who listen to this have probably already subscribed to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast. But YouTube is very crowded these days, and I understand there's a lot of great stuff on YouTube. I'm, you know, putting things up on YouTube as video coverage, you know, maybe just to get an extra 200 to 600 hits on a podcast. And I say, why not? I'm realizing that, you know, that's not necessarily worth the time. But once in a while, I do put out a video that I really, really hope people will watch, share, like, comment on. And there is a video like that at the top of our page right now. It is the Joy Camp interview highlights video. It's about 30 minutes long, and it was a ton of work. We did, I checked the stats, over 7,000 podcast downloads yesterday, and all of that attention to our RSS feed translated into 117 views of that video. So that was kind of a bummer. That video was a lot of work. And I got to tell you, it's much better than the podcast. It's got all these little enhancements like Joy Camp clips interspersed into it. So I really, really recommend that you go and check out that video. It is called Inside Joy Camp Interview Highlights. But let's get to this conversation that I had with Nick Hazelton in the middle of March. Part two of this episode coming later today is listener Q&A. Nick collected some questions from listeners, and that led to about 25 or 30 minutes of some interesting additional discussion. So I thought I'd just put that in a separate presentation. All right, everybody. I hope you enjoy this. Take care.
All right, I've got Brett Vinat back on. I think this is your third time. I think the last time we had John was with Kevin Geary on shopping for good food and yeah, being healthy.
Oh, yes, the food counseling episode.
Yes, that was very helpful. I've enjoyed that.
Are you making that work for you? Did you take our suggestions and put them into action?
I'm definitely following a lot of the stuff that Kevin goes over with Rebooted Body.
Are you eating sardines?
I actually have not eaten sardines much. I tried it once, and I didn't like it. I put it on a salad, and I just didn't enjoy it.
You really just got to mix it up, use, you know, a lot of different ingredients. So, and you just, they kind of distribute through the salad nicely if you mix it up. You want the two-layer with the skin and the bones. That's what I do. It's an easy way to get some protein and omega-3, so once you're over that smell of opening the can, you can really, I was a sardine, that's a sardine skeptic combined into one word. I was a sardine skeptic too. And then eventually I just made it part of my routine. So item number one, sardines, check.
All right. Yeah. So maybe I'll have to get into that, but
hey, you know what? One more thing. I don't want to derail your whole show with fish talk, but listen, I found out that, you know, mostly when you go to like the fish counter to buy like salmon or something, it's all farm raised salmon, but anything in a can is wild caught. Every single canned salmon that I find is wild caught. So just a tip. I don't know if we covered that last time.
I don't think so. That's interesting. So, yeah, we're going to talk about creativity today. So, School Sucks Projects, you're doing theme months this year, mm-hmm. and March is Creativity Month. And I was thinking, because I've been wondering a while, how can I improve my process in creating this show, the Anarcho-Yakitalism Podcast? What can I do to make this better, to have better productions so that I can be proud of them and so that I can give good value to my listeners? One of the ways I try to think about that is I look and compare other shows that I really enjoy, and School Sucks is definitely one of them. So I really enjoyed this last few months kind of going over what your processes are in making your show work. And so I was interested in hearing that because I heard a lot about what you're doing on the productivity side from January, Productivity Month. And now here with March is Creative Month. I thought, oh, this is perfect. I got to have Brett on to talk about what he's doing. This is my chance to ask him because this will fit right into that theme month. First off, what I want to get out is a little bit of basic grammar on what creativity is and how you use it.
Yeah, sure. The theme for March is called The Creative Pursuit, and I thought it was an important follow-up to what we've done in 2016 so far, where, you know, January was really about getting a clear runway so people actually can take off. It's working towards some kind of mission or realizing some kind, or, you know, identifying and realizing some kind of vision or purpose in life. And I realized that for a show that is about presenting solutions to the traditional schooling system, it would be wise to follow that up with a really detailed conversation about self-education, which is what I did with Steve Patterson. And now, how can we make the lessons of the first 2 months useful for, you know, creative types? So that's what we're dealing with in March. And what I'm hoping is that by next year, we'll be bringing a lot of new traffic into the site. And I want people to come to schoolsucksproject.com and see it as a very resource-rich place. The title is very negative, and I'm sure that turns a lot of people off. But I want to spend the year 2016 producing very useful self-improvement, life-enhancing type topics. We talk a lot about individual liberty on the show, which is a big part of our mission. But really teaching myself, and hopefully through that, teaching other people what is needed to live a life that is free, you know, not just politically as much as is possible in this world, but emotionally, financially, with respect to our relationships. So this year is very much about setting the stage to acquire the skills necessary to be able to handle the responsibility of freedom. And part of that is success. You know, I'm trying to take everything I do this year to the next level. So obviously being able to, you know, generate new ideas to make them actionable and to have them manifest in reality is a huge part of that. So that's a summary of what I'm doing that got us to March and partially the answer to your question. Creativity is that process of essentially bringing something new into being.
And I think it involves having an ability to really perceive the world in novel ways, to recognize up to this point unrecognized patterns, and, you know, really important too, to make connections between seemingly unrelated things. And when we're talking about whether it's, you know, self-improvement or political or economic or educational freedom, generating solutions has to be a part of that as well, or at least coming up with ways to present messages that a lot of young people, a lot of people your age, actually, Nick, would consider to be kind of bland and uninteresting compared to, you know, what else is available in the world. So creativity is multifaceted. If you have any follow-up questions about that definition, I'd be happy to answer them.
Yeah, sure. I don't really know what the etymology of creativity is, but it seems to me it's basically the ability to create, right? Would that seem to fit with what your definition is?
Well, yeah, that's actually a really interesting question, because a lot of the things that I've done that I really took a lot of pride in were actually just combinations of things that actually existed. So I definitely was very pleased with the way the John Taylor Gatto video series came out, right? But what did I do? I took visuals that were almost entirely shot by other photographers and videographers. I took scripts that were written by another man, and I took music that I didn't compose, and I combined it all into an original creation that people thought, a lot of people thought, was pretty enjoyable to watch and educational. So I created nothing, you know, from the root in that process, but wound up with something original in the end. And even, you know, Gatto himself was quite pleased with how those came out. So that would be a good marker for success as far as I'm concerned. But I guess there is that question, what did I actually create from scratch in that process? And the answer is nothing. So it was just a kind of synthesis, which is a creative process.
Sure. And that's one of the things we wanted to touch on. You mentioned this in the second episode of March. I can't remember. What's the month called?
The Creative Pursuit.
The Creative Pursuit.
Yeah.
So you mentioned that, and I believe it was the second episode, which is the last one that just came out. We're doing this on March 15th. You laid out a few models of how people creatively solve problems. And it seems that you're using Osborne's model of creative problem solving. Is that what this is called?
That's one of them. I wanted to just run through a couple of models that I thought were useful. And Alex Osborne, no relation to our Osborne at School Sucks, he was an ad man, you know, 50 years ago, very successful, actually more than 50 years ago. He was really successful during the Depression, and he produced this model. I'm actually looking for the title of the book right now as we talk, that really was aligned with a lot of the other types of models that we talk about on the show, that it has that kind of input process output quality to it. So there were three steps in Osborne's model, and I will find the title of the book. But the first step was fact finding, the second step is idea finding, and the third step is a kind of solution generation. So there you see the first question of what exists, the second question of what to do with it, or how to combine what exists to make it useful, and then that third step of actually turning it into reality, turning it into something useful. So each of those three steps was composed of two parts. So in fact-finding, the first step, the input portion of this, you have the defining of a problem, which he said, picking out what's actually wrong, but also pointing it up, which is to say, this is the outcome, or this is the goal that we have in mind for solving this problem, or this is what the solution would look like. And then you go on to the second part of the first step, which is preparation, which is basically gathering raw data and starting to analyze it. And I guess you could do it with a little bit of a filter. You don't need to pull in everything or keep everything that comes in your net, but that gives you basically, you know, a way to start generating ideas. And then you go on to that second step, which is divided into idea production and idea development. And I think that it's really important to think about the creative process as separate from the organizational process. And I think when you're trying to produce any kind of a product or a solution to the problem, both are necessary, right? So you want to have a kind of judgment-free, I can't believe I'm using that phrase, because it's like the slogan of Planet Fitness, which is one of my least favorite establishments in the world. But judgment-free in that you can generate just silly or stupid-sounding ideas. And I think I talked about doing that with students in the last episode of School Sucks. There's this kind of free exchange of say something, don't worry about being judged for what you're saying, don't worry about being criticized, and don't, you know, abstain from writing things down or saying things out loud just because your first assessment of it is like, oh, that's a stupid idea, or that would never work. I think a lot of brilliant ideas sound silly at first because there's no real context in which to understand them. So idea production is not about coming up with the best ideas. It is really quantity over quality at that stage. And then in the second part of idea finding, which is our step two, our processing, it's idea development. So you're, you know, selecting and adding and reprocessing. It's a process of refinement, right? So you go big and wide in the first one, and then you try to refine it down to something that's actually going to be usable, something that seems like there is a path between the problem and the solution at that stage. And then you move on to the third step, the output, the solution finding, which you know, starts with a kind of evaluation of the idea that you want to use, and ultimately an adoption, you know, deciding and implementing the ultimate solution. So that is Osborne's model. And I think it's just useful to think about, especially ideation, but what I added to it in the last show, ideation in that you're not trying to do everything all at once. Like, realize where you are in a process of creativity versus just saying, do I have any ideas? No. Oh, I guess I'm not creative. Put yourself on the map of creative problem solving. And what I added to that in the last show is make sure you leave time for incubation. You can deliberately go through the steps in this process, but also know that, you know, creativity from start to finish is not necessarily a 1 hour or a 1 day activity. You might have to start, you know, working towards some kind of a solution and then just drop it completely and go on to something else. Go for a walk, pick up a book, leave it be completely for a couple of weeks. So that was why I put some focus on the previous conversation on incubation strategies, ways to step away or just put something on hold for a while, which I think is really important in letting a solution grow.
That's something that I found very valuable in coming up with new ideas and how to do stuff. And just, it also helps with organization some bit, is to take the time to set other things down and be able to focus. I think that's kind of what you're getting on. And not letting things distract you, because I've found that I can be very distracted. And when I'm trying to come up with an idea for a new podcast episode or some script that I'm going to write, I might start down and get a few things. Oh, I have this idea. This is really great. And then I get distracted by a thousand other things. And then I never come back to it. And it's very disappointing. So is that, maybe I'm focusing too much on the organization and the productivity aspect there, but it seems like that kind of fits there. When you're coming up with an idea, you don't want to be distracted by everything that's going on.
Can you give me a more specific example of that happening to you? Like, maybe what was something you were trying to do a show about? What does the process of idea generation look like for you, and why do you walk away from it?
This is a good question. The one that pops into my head right now is I'm thinking about doing a show about focusing on self-ownership and how that applies to taking responsibility for your actions and self-help, I guess, improving yourself.
Okay.
And I was thinking, well, how am I going to do this? And I had this idea, okay, we lay out, what is self-ownership? What is the difference between self-ownership and autonomy? Do you control yourself? Trying to get to the point that, yeah, you do control yourself. How can you use that to help yourself do something? And then I was working on that. And I don't remember exactly what happened, but I was thinking, I was like, oh, I hit a dead end. I hit some writer's block. I don't know where to go with this right now. And I was thinking, well, how could I do this? And then I kind of got frustrated. And then I thought, wow, immediately kind of thought, well, let's work on something else and go do something else. And I haven't gone back to it for a while. And I got distracted by the frustration and then also whatever else was happening in that moment. Maybe I had to go build a fire or go to jujitsu class or something. I don't really remember, but does that provide some clarity?
Yeah. What does working on it look like for you? Are you writing a script? Are you drawing a mind map? Are you actually trying to like record your thoughts with audio?
It's writing a script.
So how carefully do you script things out?
I do it word for word. I write an essay, and then I might not follow the essay completely, but I pretty much read that off.
And then you try to basically capture it in one take or as few takes as possible?
Yeah.
What do you do before you write the script? Like, what are the raw materials that lead to the assembly of the script? What's your process like before you actually start writing what you want to say?
I've tried to move a little bit towards making an outline. Don't do that very often. I did not do that with that project. Most of the time is I have an idea. It's in my head. I thought, oh, okay, I need to capture this somehow and just kind of stream of consciousness down on the page. And then I might go over it, make sure it makes logical sense and it flows together and nothing's kind of out of place. And I might mix things around and make sure it does. And then, I kind of do a rough draft, edit it, and then a final draft.
So it kind of sounds like how somebody would write a paper in school, no?
No, exactly, yeah.
Interesting, huh? So, when I used to tutor people who are your age for the like either writing, usually for some kind of standardized test timed essay, I would say initially divide it into a creative and an organizational phase. And, for the SAT essay, you only have 25 minutes to do the whole thing, to have the finished essay or as close to finished as possible when those 25 minutes are up. So I used to work with them on like timing. Like a lot of people would read these essay questions, like an idea comes to us. So we want to start talking about it right away, just to maybe relate it to what you're talking about. So that's kind of akin to sitting down in this SAT writing session. It's always the first thing that anyone does on the SAT. And being told, you have 25 minutes to write an essay, time starts now. Most people are just going to start writing the essay right away, right? You get a prompt and it's like, basically, do you feel this way or this way about this issue, right? I can't think of any of the questions off the top of my head. But I know the one I used on the show before is conscience a more powerful motivator than money, fame, and power? Are people more motivated by what their conscience tells them to do, or are they more motivated by the desire for things like money, fame, and power? That was an example that I used on the show in the past. And that's a yes or no question. Or it's not a yes or no question. It's an either or question. It's a binary choice, like a yes or no question. It's either yes, conscience, or no, it's money, fame, and power. So people react to that. Conscience sounds like it would be the right answer. So they just start writing these very sort of bland, uncreative responses like, how terrific to have a conscience. And then you have to use examples, right? You're making an argument, so you have to back up your work. So Nick, who are some people in your mind who were clearly, like, indisputably motivated by conscience over money, fame, and power?
Ooh, that's a good question. I can't think of anybody who has a whole lot of money, fame, and power.
But you can go anyone in the world. It can be anyone in the world.
I'm gonna say my father. That's the first person that pops in my head.
Okay. So, all right, then maybe you would have a track to write that essay. But for most people, they're looking for like historical or literary or political examples. So they just start listing off like Martin Luther King, Mother Teresa, Rosa Parks, Harriet Tubman. They get pretty crazy sometimes and say things like Abraham Lincoln. But everybody winds up basically, they say conscience and then they write the same essay. And they don't distinguish themselves as being particularly original or interesting or insightful on the subject because they just reacted to it. They snapped right into an organizational process and skipped the creative process completely, which I think school encourages people to do. But if you were just able to spend, instead of having to spend 3 minutes trying to generate ideas because you have to finish an essay in 25 minutes, like if you just remove those time constraints, which is now your situation, say you could just spend a day saying, I'm just going to generate as many, I'm going to put this in the back of my mind and I'm just going to periodically throughout the day, or I'm going to even sit down with a piece of paper and a pencil or, draw a mind map and just try to generate as many ideas about this as possible. You're separating a creative process, which is idea generation, essentially that idea production part of step 2 in the Osborne model, from the idea development, which is actually, you know, the refinement and the moving forward with what you're actually going to use. Just come up with as many dumb ideas as possible about something and start there.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. And I think that would be valuable. Yeah, it's just nice to have those ideas in case, you know, this is a, I decide one day, okay, I don't want to really mess with the yaks today. I want to write something. Then I can go through my pool of ideas and pick one that I decide I want to. I think that would be very valuable.
Yeah, or you just write down a bunch of ideas, then go mess with the yaks. And then, you know, it just continues to kind of form as you're doing something else. You turn it over to your subconscious. That's that incubation process. Put it away. You stop actively trying to solve the creative problem and you just move on to something else. But you've started the wheels turning creatively by going through an idea production process. So here's some examples of how I would do that. Sometimes I'll know what the topic is for the next show. This hasn't happened in a while because things have been much more structured this year. But I'll sit down and I'll get into the position like I'm going to record a podcast. I'll put my headphones on. I'll put my microphone in front of me and I'll open the, you know, Audacity and I'll just start hitting record and I'll just start talking and I'll talk for maybe 3 or 4 minutes just freely, you know, because I know that this probably isn't going to be the podcast. And then after 3 or 4 minutes, I'll just stop and maybe I'll listen back to it. Maybe I'll only make it like 30 seconds into it and then I'll delete it. And then maybe I'll try it again. I listen to myself try to talk through ideas and then I'll start writing things down and then I'll start a refinement process. But sometimes I like to just sit down and, you know, start trying to talk through things because the medium that I use is talking. So we've had this discussion on the show before. I know I had it with MK Lords and a couple other people in the past about how prepared should your podcast be, you know, how much should you write things out? And I guess everybody's different and different things can certainly work for different people, but this is a spoken medium, right? So I want to prepare for it with talking. It doesn't mean that I don't have outlines and notes and don't do research, but when I'm actually trying to generate what the show is going to be, I'll just sit down and try to talk through it. You know, I don't even save it as like outtakes or anything. Most of it just gets deleted. And that actually has helped me refine ideas. Now, everybody could be listening and saying, that sounds completely insane and like a waste of time. And I would never do that. But that's just been part of my process. It's that kind of freedom at the beginning to experiment with things.
Sure. Yeah, I found value in doing things like that. I do that a lot of times with my outros to show. I do my intro. I record my intros and outros separately from whatever show I'm putting out. So the intro is very easy because I try to keep it short. But the outro, I can go on and on forever. And if I don't write a script, I do a few takes and I'll go and then I'll decide, well, I don't like the way I went through that. And I might listen back. And then I slowly get better. And I kind of feel like it's a waste of time most of the time. And I think, oh, Nick, I should have just wrote a script. But every time I do it, I thought, oh, I can do it. I can do it this time. I'll do it once. I'm like, no, that was terrible. That was terrible. Let's do it one more time. It'll only take one more time. I'm like, mm-hmm. Hey, you should probably write a script. Just write it out. At least write down some ideas that you want to hit. I can see how that could be valuable for somebody. I'll have to experiment with it some more before I say that's valuable for me. But I can understand because that makes sense to me. Being able to hear the way you say it and being able, because like you said, you use talking as your medium. That's a way of communicating. You want to be able to communicate your ideas. Because that's kind of your job, right? That is your job. So, yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. If you want to be able to talk through your ideas, having that, it's a form of practice, right? And then also, you know, understanding how that's going to sound after you're done thinking of what, you know, whatever it is.
Well, for me, I think that this is good advice generally. Like all the things that I do, like I said before, other people might listen to this conversation and say, that's insane. Why would you do that? But I think something that is pretty solid and consistent advice across the, you know, the entire spectrum of podcasting or video production is having a medium that matches your personality, right? So for me, that's not writing. You know, like I like to talk in silly voices. That doesn't come through in writing. You know, there's no way to communicate a funny accent or a silly old man voice in writing. So for me, what best matches my personality is speaking, you know? And I had a lot of practice with that before I ever started podcasting. I had, you know, had to entertain groups of people or keep groups of people fairly entertained in school settings for like 10 years. So I had a lot of practice doing that. So for me, you know, that medium personality matching is really important. So I just start there. I don't start with a pen and paper and a script because I know ultimately no one's going to see that. I just start experimenting in the medium that I'm actually going to use, which is with my voice.
Okay.
And but I totally see, like, somebody has, you know, I've known people who've written scripts and I don't like the way that I think I would look doing that, but it could totally work perfectly for somebody else. So I think the important takeaway there is, you know, having use a medium and spend time in a medium that ultimately is going to match your personality best.
Yeah, absolutely. That makes perfect sense. So going back to the basics,
mm-hmm.
I covered what creativity is. How do we apply creativity? And I think there's probably an obvious answer, but I'm just not able to articulate it. Another way to phrase it would be, how does creativity help somebody?
Okay, well, I think it gives you, especially, and I think it's actually a really good follow-up to what we've been talking about, is it gives you novel ways of thinking about problems, right? So you heard me in the last show, I used the terms convergent and divergent thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And convergent thinking is very much like, I'm guessing this is like where the saying think outside of the box, which is so cliche, I don't even like to use it for anything, but I'm thinking this is where that phrase came from, in response to the limitations of convergent thinking. So in school, we think convergently. On multiple choice tests, we think convergently. We're told that there is a right answer, a best answer to a problem. There is never anything that can be better. There's only four choices. Three of the choices are not as good, and one is the best choice. So you have to use your thinking to narrow it down to that one best choice, and then you can move beyond that question, that homework question, that multiple choice problem, knowing you have picked the absolute best answer that will ever exist to that problem. But divergent thinking is very much the opposite of that. It is out of that convergent thinking box. There could be myriad solutions to a given problem. When you first say them, like the man who introduces exploding liquid vehicle for humans, a lot of them will sound stupid. So having an environment, and if you're working by yourself, this is a very easy environment to create. If you're working inside an organization, it's probably a little bit more difficult. And a lot of organizations are not particularly good at fostering creativities. I had a lot of my ideas when I worked in this school and I wanted to change things. I had a lot of my ideas shut down just because they were different. And it's like, no, because even though this is what we do now and it kind of works, at least it kind of works. You know, we don't want to devote time and resources and energy and thought to what you're talking about because it might not work at all. So let's just stick with what kind of works and what kind of gets by. Being in conditions where people can think divergently, where that kind of thinking is welcome, that there might not be a best answer. There might not only be four or five possibilities for solving this problem. Anytime you can put yourself in that kind of a setting, the benefits can be great because it turns on the idea generating machine of the mind, you know, and that gives you all kinds of additional resources to not only solve problems, but even to think about problems, to move around a problem and see it from different angles and different perspectives.
Yeah, and I think you're right. There's a lot of times it's kind of discouraged to come up with new ideas, right? To try and do things differently. And it is valuable when we can, right? Because that's progress, right? Coming up with these new ideas. If people didn't come up with crazy ideas like the exploding liquid vehicle, right? We wouldn't have cars.
Exactly. And we wouldn't have something like libertarianism either.
Oh, absolutely. I guess if you want to come up with new ideas, then creativity is the way to do it because that's the only way, really. That's the process to get there. I think that's pretty self-evident.
Yeah, and even combining, you know, or even like recognizing patterns of pre-existing things, because a lot of people will just judge themselves not creative because they can't do purely original work, like make a film or do a painting or write a poem. But the definition, as we've already talked about, is much broader than that. So it really just starts with, you know, having a mind that is open to and welcoming to new unorthodox and even uncomfortable ideas. You know, there's a lot of people who, you know, might be in your audience or might be in my audience because of their political or philosophical orientation. They're already using those muscles because they're thinking outside prescribed paradigms. But there's also could be a lot of people, maybe, and you and I included in that, that haven't maximized our potential just because we haven't been able to spend enough time thinking about how that can actually, those types of thinking that we've applied to things like maybe religion or politics or society or the media or the schools, how we can actually apply it more to our own lives. And there could be great rewards for spending some time contemplating how to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things I try to get out in the show, and the main overarching thing I like to push, is how to live a good life. And that's related to ethics and philosophy, right? That's why I study ethics. I think the goal of ethics is to live a good life. So I like to push that. And I'm wondering how this can apply to that. Now, we can see where it helps, right? We can come up with new ideas in whatever field we're doing can be very helpful, especially if you're in a sector that's creating things like podcasts. You need to create new ideas, and teaching, you need to come up with new ideas. You don't need to, but you know, the idea is you want to come up with new ways to get people entertained and to keep your students entertained and learning, right? Mm-hmm. So I think pretty much every field you can get into involves some creativity, but I'm kind of wondering on how that can help in the philosophical process and trying to discover new ideas, or maybe not even come up with a new philosophy, but explore new philosophies. And the thing that's popping in my head is I don't think that a lot of people apply creativity to philosophy because they get stuck in their old pattern of thought, classic conservative mindset, right? They don't want to explore anything beyond their conservative values, right? They don't want to consider that, hey, maybe we should let homosexuals marry each other, right?
Mm. Oh, but my head is, as you're saying this, my head is just like filling with examples of what I think you're talking about. So, you know, I grew up watching Martin Scorsese movies. Are you fairly familiar with Martin Scorsese, the film director?
I know that name, but I can't think of any films he's made.
The last one that he made is escaping me, but he made Shutter Island, The Departed, Hugo, Goodfellas, Casino, Raging Bull, Taxi Driver. He works with Leonardo DiCaprio a lot now, but before that, he is his actor, like his canvas basically as a director was Robert De Niro.
Yes.
When he was younger, he was an absolutely brilliant, just mesmerizing and captivating actor. All of his performances were just so engrossing and amazing. And you see that, you know, his ability to transform and to like go inside these people that he was playing, and Scorsese's ability to direct him so perfectly to do so, you just see like the amazing creative potential that people like them have. I mean, I would add Spielberg. I think Spielberg has done some, you know, I think he's considered very commercial and all that, but he is an incredibly talented filmmaker. You know, and so I often think about creativity in that realm, those kinds of people that I've looked up to in the past. I guarantee you everybody I named is going to vote for Hillary Clinton, you know. So it's exactly like people show this tremendous ability in the artistic world, and this ability to like think beyond what anybody else has done in a certain realm. But then they're stuck in like the smallest box, you know, in another room. They've compartmentalized, you know, all of that questioning of what is and asking what is possible in a certain respect. They don't apply that to the world of like politics, say, where it's like, oh, Clinton. Yeah. OK. Yeah. Because her last name is Clinton and she's a woman and she's a Democrat. And so am I. So, OK, thought about that enough. Right. But, you know, that's not the kind of thinking that produced Robert De Niro's performance in Raging Bull or, you know, Martin Scorsese's masterpiece Goodfellas. But those people will vote for Hillary Clinton. So that's the compartmentalization that you're talking about, right? Even people who have this incredible ability won't apply it to the philosophical world. Or am I misunderstanding you completely?
No, that's exactly what I'm going for, actually. And I guess my follow-up question, and this might be a hard question to answer. It's hard to psychoanalyze people. But why do you think that might be? Why do people apply certain creativity in one area and not in another?
I really don't. There's probably a raw talent component to it. There's a nature component to it. There's probably a nurture component to it. You know, like back to Robert De Niro, I mean, he grew up in an acting family, but then there is a kind of raw talent to it. You know, like Martin Scorsese, who became this great film director, he was like a little Catholic altar boy, son of immigrants from Italy, you know, growing up in New York City. And he just had these incredible, you know, powers of observation. There could be a number of reasons why somebody becomes highly creative, but what stops them in other areas, I really don't know. I mean, in those cases, I can't even speculate because we're talking about really specific people. But, you know, more generally, fear, discomfort, lack of leftover energy. You've poured so much of yourself into one kind of pursuit that you just haven't ever like really spent the time thinking that a similar type of exploration is possible politically or philosophically or economically or educationally. I don't know.
Well, I guess, there are a few fields of interest that I kind of stick to, right? I stick to farming. You know, what can I do with these yaks? What can I do with these animals? And I wouldn't say I apply too much creativity, but it's something I think I will start doing. But most of the creative process where I kind of focus it on would be on political and philosophical ideas. And I can see why, you know, it's just not very appealing to me to start working on something else. You know, I want to focus my energy on my way of communicating with other people about these ideas rather than starting up something new like filmmaking. Like it's just not part of my interest in doing that. And I just don't really have the time to focus on something like that while being able to apply the same focus on what I like, which is philosophical ideas. So I can get that.
Well, yeah, I mean, there could be a tremendous lie. But I mean, I've had theories about why Hollywood types, which is what we were just talking about, have this aversion to a kind of political open-mindedness, which means embracing anything other than like the traditional left, is because, you know, if you're giving away millions of dollars of your money every year, you have a lot of stake in the system and you could drop what you're doing and actually work to try to make positive changes or to see that the system delivers what your ideas of a healthy and harmonious society are, whether they're right or wrong. So you have people, you know, like Angelina Jolie or Sean Penn, you know, think of them what you will, but they've asserted themselves in these arenas beyond just saying, I'm going to vote for Al Gore, you know. But then I think for a lot of people who are, you know, in Hollywood and they have these, you know, multi-million dollar a year tax burdens, it would be incredibly uncomfortable to look at government for what it actually is, because you're feeding that, you know, a lot of fuel every year with your productivity. And I think that what's more comforting, you know, Hollywood hasn't generally produced the most, you know, mentally healthy and self-aware people. I mean, I'm sure there's plenty of them, but there's also plenty who aren't. What's more comforting than really, really living consciously and accepting what is creating a kind of fantasy about what's possible with your money, you know? And I think a lot of people do that instead of asking themselves or repurposing some of their creative or exploratory energy into that arena. They just say, oh, well, I've constructed this, what I want, this aspiration that I have. So I'll just go with that because it's easier. I mean, that's a theory. There seems to be a lot of that. And I've talked to some people who, you know, work in that world or are more familiar with that world. And they seem to think that that was a reasonable theory.
Yeah, it makes sense. Sure. Since I've got you about 25 more minutes, I want to end off just kind of going over, you know, what are you doing? Specifically, what is your process? And you kind of touched on that in the last couple episodes of School Sucks. I guess my first question is, why are you trying to generate ideas?
Depends on what you're talking about. I mean, the goals are always very different depending on what I'm working on.
To gain some clarity, what are the fields of interest that you are trying to generate ideas with? Yeah. So like your podcast, you have to generate some ideas for something else. Like, yeah, you know, whatever it is for your diet, right? You have to generate some new ideas.
Well, I would say as far as work is concerned, all my idea generation goes into audio and video production and how to make it as visible as possible. Production of content, distribution and organization of content, and presentation is a part of it as well. Like, how does it all come together into some kind of coherent picture? That's definitely something that I've put a lot of thought into in the last 3 or 4 months. So most of my creative energies go in one of those directions, or seemingly in many of those directions all at once.
Why are you trying to get new ideas?
Because I think I want it to be continuously interesting and inspiring and motivating to me. I think there could be, like, you know, a real technician approach to this, where you just figure out something that works, and then you just continue to hammer that nail forever. But I want to keep doing this. I really like the process that I go through. I really like, you know, being able to put out a finished product. I like people's feedback. And you know, I like the creation process from beginning to end and after. And I felt this way before. If it starts to get stale, something needs to change, because I'm just becoming like an operator of that and not really a creator. Like, I could put out shows on autopilot. And I think I've done it before. And I even said in the last show, like, it's very, very important to me for the long term for the School Sucks project to be able to build this repertoire of really actionable, useful self-improvement type content that can be showcased on the website. But it puts limitations on creativity, because everything has to exist within a theme. The time frames are really tight. So sometimes I have to let things go before they're what I really want them to be, versus, like, if I'm working on some show that's like history based, or like the show on James Bond that I did with Osborne and Gardner at the end of last year. I worked on that for like over 30 hours. You know, because I could, and because I wasn't going to put it out until it was done. But when you work with deadlines, and when you work within kind of narrower theme restrictions, creativity is something that in many cases I think is going to be sacrificed. I'm not saying it has to be, but that's what I'm finding the casualty has been, just a little bit. I'm not saying that, you know, I'm really, really worried about it, but it is not the optimal conditions to be maximally creative. You know, that's a problem of, like, consistent release. You know, like, my friend Richard Grove, who does the Peace Revolution podcast, if he needs a month and a half or 2 months to finish a podcast, he'll take it. And for me, I want to be putting out, you know, like, one or two things every week. It's a problem I've dealt with. I've been, like, in radio networks that require to, like, stay in the network, you have to produce a show every week. So I've just always kind of put myself into that way of working. Like, every week there needs to be a new show. So if 7 days pass, there will have been a new show. But that's certainly, you know, suboptimal when it comes to producing the absolute best product, or really, you know, truly fulfilling creative potential.
Yeah, sure. I face that issue because I'm on LRN.
Yeah,
so
me too.
Yeah, right. So you have to produce so much content. And there have been times where I'm like, oh no, what am I going to do? And now what I do is, I make sure that I do a couple interviews a week, sometimes less and sometimes a little bit more, but I try to stay on about the same thing. So I have content to produce if I can't think of anything to do on my own. But no, I understand that frustration and working with that timeline and that deadline. My dad has said this, I think, before, is that you have to, and I've heard teachers say this too, actually. They try to provide some guidelines because they say, well, that's where creativity actually will come out. I think it's different for people who are more interested in self-education. But, you know, when they, I think this is my social studies teacher. He said, well, I put these limits in there to see if what people can do. And if I don't provide those guidelines, you know, people don't know what to do. Maybe it's not because they're creative enough to come up with their own idea and they need a little bit of a push. But it seems that providing those constrictions will, you know, cause people to find new and really creative ways to get around them. And you can see this with loopholes in laws, right? You know, I'm working on setting up a dairy with my father, and there are all kinds of crazy regulations on dairies. Mm-hmm. But what people have done is they found, like, amazing, even crazier ways to get around that. You can't sell raw milk and deliver it to people, but you can have a herd share. You can sell people shares of your herd, and then you can deliver milk to them because it's their milk. Right. So I'm wondering, do you think that there's a point there, and where would that fit in? Do you think that constrictions can provide some a new kind of creativity in a way. And maybe it's not as helpful for you and I, where we want to take time to make a really great product, because obviously those regulations hinder us in a way. But do you think that it does spurn some new types of creativity?
Yeah, I think that that's definitely possible. You know, limitation can be, like, all types of limitation can be great for creativity. And I think that, you know, when I was talking about this recently with somebody, like, working on what I do with very, very limited resources means that originally I had to come up with all kinds of inventive ways to solve problems and get things done. They might not have been the best way to do it or the fastest way to do it, but it forced me to use my mind in new ways to solve problems. And I think that by and large, that has been a beneficial process. So I think limitation can have its benefits. I think I've realized some of that. Tell me a little bit more about, you said this was your history teacher that you had. He said that he needed to have, like, some limitations for people to work in. Can you give, like, an example of, like, a project where that was true?
The one I'm thinking of is we had to create our own country. And we got to come up with all certain things, but there were some limitations, right? We had these rules. This is what you have to follow. It seems that his point was kids aren't going to know exactly what to do unless you give them some guidelines to follow and a little bit of restriction on what they can do. Like, you have to give them that time limit. Otherwise, they're not going to work on it. And if they do, they're going to take way too long.
Well, I think that school has that kind of set up because people want excuses to not do things, right?
Sure.
So if something was left incredibly open-ended, I think that that would be the ammunition that a lot of people would use against the teacher. Because school is about, you know, even though I know the school you went to was different than the traditional public schooling experience, it's a school. Right. So it has a top down structure and all the expectations and restrictions that to a certain extent that come with that top down style of learning. So people are there to be told what to do. It is a very creativity stifling type of environment. I forget who it was. I feel like it was a military guy. Interestingly enough, maybe it was Patton who said something like, don't tell people how to do something. Tell them what to do and let them surprise you, right? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I could imagine it being a very sort of uninspired project if the teacher was just like, step one, do this, step two, do this, in the process of creating something. So what would be like the kind of thing that you would have been creating in this class through this carefully guided process that the teacher is laying out?
Well, we'd have to lay out, we'd have to make a country. Map of our country.
Okay.
We'd have to make a government. Prior to that semester, that was the semester project, semester before that, we would study a country and go over things like infrastructure, economy, religion, culture. And so we would have to make that up for this country, for our new country that we're making.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think the first example you gave of making your own is definitely an example of creative work. The one before that, not so much. I like working without deadlines. You know, that doesn't really work in school. I mean, that's just not part of that environment. You can't just say do it when you want, because nobody would really ever do anything. I find that creativity is the price that gets paid in meeting deadlines. Not always, but a lot of the time. But then, you know, I saw a couple comments. A listener named John left a comment on the School Sucks page saying that he seems to work very well creatively under that kind of pressure. But I see it as a limitation. So in school, everything is deadline driven. In the work world, everything is deadline driven. So I think by and large, because of those environments, people, there's a lot of unrealized creative potential because of that.
Sure. And it seems like the issue would be self-motivation, right? You're not motivated by your own desires when you're in school, right? You're motivated by pleasing the teachers and getting grades and pleasing your family or whatever. That's the goal there. But with working on your own project on your own, it's completely self-motivated. There's the only reason why you're making School Sucks is because, it is your job. It's your way of making money, but it's because you desire to, right? The only reason why you worked on that podcast for 30 hours, that episode for 30 hours, is because you wanted to. And if you didn't want to, and then somebody else was throwing deadlines at you, you know, that would be a different story. Like, if nobody gave you a deadline for something you didn't want to do, you're not going to do it, obviously.
Yeah. Now, I'll amend that a little bit because I'm thinking about it a little bit more, just like in my own production history. I did feel like I benefited from doing a live show every week. Like, have you ever thought about doing this with LRN? You what?
I have thought of it. It's part of my...
Was on your list of goals that we talked about before. Yeah, all right, that's right. Yeah. This was a kind of structure that allowed me to at least work in frames, right? So by Thursday at 10 p.m. Eastern, I had to have a plan to execute on the show for 2 hours. And then by the time next Thursday rolled around, I had to have what the raw material that we produced in the live recording edited and enhanced with, you know, music and whatever other additions there were going to be to that and out for production before the next one rolled around. So that put me on a kind of schedule and gave me a kind of organization I felt at the time was helpful. But that was also 2012. I really wasn't taking the reins of the productivity thing then, like I'd done, you know, in 2013 and beyond, really like embracing GTD and using Evernote. I didn't really have any systems then. So I needed that externally imposed structure. And I felt like that helped with creative work because I had to, you know, go through this initial process. I couldn't just wind up all over the place. I had to go through this initial process of idea generation. What is the show about? What kind of enhancements are we going to use during the production? What am I going to do to it after it's produced? But I don't really feel like I need to work with that kind of structure anymore. I think that using GTD, clearing the runway, has really helped. So I think I can better systematize my own creativity without having to put deadlines on things. But I understand why some people think deadlines are helpful. You know, as I'm reflecting on more of my own experience, it did give me a different way to think about work or to better put my work into phases or compartments where I could be more focused on trying to achieve a certain goal or solve a creative problem. But I really feel that by and large, the best work I've done is without externally imposed deadlines. Hey, everybody, be sure to check out part 2. Thank you so much for listening and take care.